Welcome to PEMA On Demand, where we explore the journeys of physician leaders rewriting the rules of medicine and business. I'm your host, Dr. Norm Chapin, and today's guest proves that sometimes the biggest breakthroughs start with burnout. Dr. Joseph Nunu, 2020 graduate of the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, left behind a successful anesthesia practice to found Oros Pharma, a startup laser-focused on fighting the opioid crisis with a novel reformulated medication. What began as a PEMBA OAP and kitchen experiments during the pandemic has evolved into a purpose-driven biotech company on the cusp of preclinical trials and FDA engagement. In today's episode, Joseph opens up about the financial risks, personal transformation, faith-fueled mission, and the hard-earned lessons from bootstrapping a pharmaceutical venture from scratch. He also shares how PEMBA helped him move from an idea to implementation and why he believes physicians must play a bigger role in shaping the future of pharma. Get ready for a candid, inspiring conversation about resilience, reformulation, and the reinvention of one physician's career and purpose. Welcome to PEMBA On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. PEMBA On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare career development, and healthcare leadership. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to these terms. Whether you're sipping your morning coffee, commuting to the hospital, or just looking for a dose of inspiration, we've got you covered. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. PEMBA On Demand will allow you to be an even bigger force for good in healthcare. Well, Joseph, I'd like to welcome you to PEMBA On Demand. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Norm. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm really excited to have you share your story with the alumni and with our audience. And as we prepared for this, I was just fascinated by your story that both before and after PEMBA. But I wonder if you could start out by sharing a little bit with the audience about what was happening in your life, career, when you realized that you really needed to get a better handle on the business side of medicine.
So the business side of medicine was always interesting and elusive to me. In fact, I first looked into getting an MBA while I was still in medical school. Georgetown University offered an online or like a hybrid program. This would have been back in the early 2000s. And when I told them I was a medical student, they said, no way. Never going to happen. You can't do both. And it turns out they were right. So it was good advice. Plus, it was also very expensive and I didn't have the extra money. But in any case, I thought I would kind of pick up the business knowledge along the way and was somewhat disappointed that after roughly 10 years in practice, I didn't really feel like I had a good handle on business other than the basics. You know, ins have to be greater than outs if you want to stay afloat, you know, basic stuff like that. And during, you know, towards the end of my full-time clinical practice, I began seeing indications that our practice wasn't being run from a business perspective as well as it could be, and decided that between knowing that I needed to understand it from a personal level to make sure that to insulate myself from any bad business practices, I decided that it was time for me to get an MBA and get some formal business training. And interestingly, that was just coincidentally right around the time that COVID hit. Of course, I'm a PEMBA 2020. And with that, the cracks in our business management really became evident that we weren't just making money because we were good business people. We were making money because we were anesthesiologists and part of that means you have an income, but our business practices were weak. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship? Did you have were you an independent practice? Were you employed, an employed group with a hospital?
So we were a private practice contract with the hospital, and the group had been very successful. They'd managed multiple contract updates over 25 years before I got there, 20 some years before I got there. And they really had turned their practice around from a losing practice to one that was doing well. So I guess in their mind, they were doing quite well, but they're comparing themselves to a different standard, I guess.
And COVID was a tough time. I mean, there were a lot of cancellations of elective cases and those kinds of things. I think that put a lot of stress on surgical and anesthesia practices.
It absolutely did. One of the things I picked up from PEMBO or somewhere along the way in my business readings is during times of economic challenge, strong businesses thrive, adequate businesses or marginal businesses survive, and weak businesses fail. And we were plummeting. And if it wasn't for the PPP part of things, I think we might have gone under. Our income was drastically reduced and we were losing contracts, and we were also unable to successfully bid on new contracts. We'd bid on at least two or three off the top of my head that we did not win. And we didn't win them because we weren't responsive to the demands of the market and we weren't able to adapt our model. And I think that's one of the important things in business is being flexible and being willing to adapt to the market. You know, if you don't evolve, you go extinct.
So I know you've said, as we've kind of prepared for this, that besides just picking up the business knowledge, there were other factors that kind of drove you to seek your MBA that you'd been thinking about for a long time. Can you share with the audience a few of those other factors that kind of precipitated this decision in 2020 for you?
Yeah. So I was growing increasingly unhappy, burned out, dissatisfied with my clinical practice. And it wasn't that I didn't enjoy anesthesia. I love the patients and I love the practice of medicine. But ultimately, it affected my mood, my lifestyle, my happiness. It affected my family. And I felt that there was a change that was needed. So between wanting to learn more about the business runnings of our practice and also looking at potentially going into the administrative side of medicine, as a lot of physicians do, especially when they get burned out, those were two major factors. And the final factor was this interest in starting a pharmaceutical company. This was an idea that first came about to me in 2017. I started exploring it in 2018 and kind of put it aside once I realized that I didn't have the skill set or at least the business knowledge set to be able to advance the idea. And, you know, part of me, when I started entering business school, I thought, you know, maybe I'll learn something here that will help me understand what it takes to cross that chasm between an idea and its final implementation.
So it sounds like when you went into PEMBA, you were really looking to do something that was really completely different than staying in hospital administration or managing an anesthesia practice.
Yes, I'd almost say it was a bit of a dream or a fantasy, but it was certainly there in my mind. And in fact, most of whenever we had a choice to, you know, kind of gear our educational process or, you know, when we do our business plan, it was all towards the exploration of this pharmaceutical business and developing a business plan strategy.
So when did the idea of starting a pharmaceutical company look like it would be the solution for you and for your family as compared to remaining in the clinical practice of anesthesia?
I think that was, first of all, it's a very good question. I think it was more of a slow realization than it was a profound moment. I can't define a particular moment when that was clearly the way forward. But what I can say is that as I was growing increasingly unhappy in clinical practice, I found that the pursuit of this new mission gave me purpose and excited me. And allowed me to use my skill set, allows me to treat many more people. If you know, you consider, you know, being able to dispense medications nationwide or even internationally, you're able to reach and save many more lives. So I became increasingly interesting, and the potential just felt so much more rewarding than my day-to-day was in clinical practice at that time.
I would say in general that many physicians have maybe a jaundiced view of big pharma at least. Did that have any impact or create any fear in you as you decided to go down this road?
It didn't create fear. It definitely had an impact. And I have certainly jaundiced, to use your term, which I like very much, jaundiced against pharmaceutical industry. I'll give a brief tale. When I was relatively early in practice, I mean, I've been in practice 5-6 years or so, a gentleman came in purveying this new anti-nausea medicine called Emend. And Emend was billed as being a single tablet that significantly reduces nausea and vomiting and prevents readmissions at a significant rate and makes patients happier, yada, yada. And I asked the drug rep, you know, what's the bottom line? What's the cost of this drug? And I can't remember, it was like $50 or $60. And this would have been in roughly 2014 or something. And I'm like, that's a lot of money for a single pill. He says, yeah, but think about how expensive it is if you have to be admitted and you're saving money. And he was right. And this whole time I was just angry with him. And I said, how much do the seatbelts in your car cost? Think about how much money they're going to save you if you get into a wreck. I mean, you can't charge like that. But of course, it was a very simplistic view. And I was very naive and also very jaundiced against the pharmaceutical industry. I saw them as a bunch of scammers and just trying to get money. And as I went through learning about the practice, business and the pharmaceutical industry, I did come to appreciate that there are drivers of these costs. So what I aim to do is minimize that by running a very lean startup, not wasting any money. I drive an economical car. I'm very choosy about the contracts and the consultants I have. I have a very low burn rate, which allows me to sustain this pace. I kind of made a commitment to myself and anyone who would hear me that I'm not going to be like those other guys. This is not a get rich quick scheme, and it's not a let's see how much money, how fast I can make it. So my goal is to save lives and to do so as effectively and accessibly and affordably as possible.
So when you started up the pharmaceutical company, and pharmacy is a very complex business, at least to my mind, did you wait until you had a minimally viable product that you were already making some money on, or did you pivot into this startup at a different point?
I pivoted into the startup with an idea. So okay. Before I had taken this leap, it was 2018. Again, not knowing anything about business, not knowing anything about the market, that I started asking some friends in the pharmaceutical industry what I needed to know. Where do I start? And they were super helpful and just pointing me either to somebody who could answer my questions or giving me little tidbits of knowledge or telling me where to start, that I was able to explore what it would take to bring this idea to fruition. And what that led to was a market analysis research. Market research, basically market analysis. And I paid a guy to do that and, you know, paid him quite well, but he did a fantastic job. And he came back to me and he says, I want to found this company with you. This is a great idea. He was very excited about it. And I says, we're not even close to that. Because again, I had a full-time job. I have 5 kids. I've got a mortgage and, couldn't let go of those golden handcuffs. And when I started meeting with other people, I started exploring this idea because it was gnawing in the back of my head as the opioid epidemic was just going terribly, especially for Appalachia, which is where I was based in Eastern Tennessee, and just watching the death rates go from 50 to 70 to 80 to 90,000. I thought, you know, I felt guilty at that point sitting on a potential solution and not pursuing it. So when I had this potential solution, I ran it by a friend of mine, basically retired or semi-retired person in the pharmaceutical industry, really nice guy, very godly man. He kind of pointed me in some directions and gave me some ideas, and I bought lab equipment and started doing experiments in my kitchen and started learning a little bit more about the chemistry. And it's amazing what you can learn online. There's a website called PubChem that gives you all the physical properties of various molecules, including this active pharmaceutical ingredient that we're using. And was able to extrapolate that information and formed an idea that I said, yeah, this is potentially viable. And at the same time, had a falling out with my anesthesia group, and we tendered my resignation and left about 6 months later. Went out, 2021. This would have been March 2021 was when I started the company, and April 2021 was when I quit full time practice.
So I'd be interested if you have any recollections of the first conversation you had with your spouse about this change in your direction. And was this a shock to her, or was this something that you'd been discussing for some time?
It wasn't a shock to her. She knew how unhappy I was in clinical practice, to the point where it did cause some strain within our family, not so much within our marriage, but I became the grumpy dad and was tense. And that's not good for our kids, and it's not good for our home. And I will never forget this, Norm. This was a very poignant moment for me. This was in April of 2020. So, you know, COVID is underway. You know, we've done the, you know, safer at home challenge, I guess. And the my wife and I were at the kitchen table, and the kids were outside playing. It was middle of the day. And she's like, "So what do you want to do?" And I said, "Sweetheart, I don't know. What I really want is I want to get out of this, you know, practice of medicine the day in, day out. I'm exhausted. I'm grumpy. I'm unhappy. But to do that, the only thing I can think of is either we move, which we didn't want to move, or we start a business." And I said, "We start a business now. We've got 4-year-old daughters. It's going to take me 10 years to get it up and running. You know, they're going to be then 14. I'm going to miss all this time with them. So I really don't know." And she paused and she said, "I meant, what do you want to do today?" And I was like, whoa, I totally misread that. And she could tell that I had a lot on my mind. So it really wasn't a surprise. And I'll tell you, Norm, she is an absolutely amazing woman. She was, is, and I believe always will be super supportive of this. She knows my heart. She supports the mission. She has sacrificed a lot as far as me traveling, our finances, you know, have invested a significant amount of our personal finances. And she's never once complained. She's just been super supportive. And so, you know, behind every successful man is a great woman, or whatever the saying is. And that's certainly true in this scenario.
Well, it certainly sounds like it. And it sounds like she was very, she just recognized how important it was to you and how important it was for your relationship with the family as well, which I think is great. Is great.
Yes, sir.
So we've talked about you starting up a pharmaceutical company. Maybe you could share with us, what solution are you trying to bring to market, and why are you so passionate about that solution?
So the solution we're trying to bring is one that will save more lives than our current therapeutic options with drug overdose. At least that's how it started. So Narcan is a fantastic drug. It's saved countless lives over the last, I guess, 6 decades. It was invented in the 60s. But it's got a glaring blind spot when it comes to treating large fentanyl overdoses and overdoses with non-opiate chemicals like xylazine, the animal or veterinarian tranquilizer, benzos, and usually it's a mixture of other substances. So without Narcan being able to treat those things, I knew that, you know, there was something else we needed to do that would use a whole different approach. And so we've developed this new formulation of an old molecule, again, that's sticking with the theme of keeping costs down rather than start with a whole new molecule that has to be vetted and tested and will have a high failure rate. We started with something we already knew worked, also approved in the 60s. I personally use it in the operating room myself to stimulate respirations in a patient. And, you know, just it's a molecule that fell out of disuse because there was no longer a need for it in the operating room. So not primarily what was being used. So we developed this formulation, and as we're going through, we thought, you know, there are a lot more indications that we could apply this formulation to. So we have an aging population that has severe emphysema or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. We have drowning victims, usually or many times it's children. And we have folks who, of course, stop breathing when they suffer from sudden cardiac death or, you know, fatal arrhythmias. And the question that we've kicked around is, can this medication fill a role with those folks too? So we're exploring that, and it's just a need to do more, especially in the light of, you know, living in Appalachia, seeing, you know, we have a previous coworker whose 3-year-old son drowned. I met a wonderful young lady when I was a resident who was a substance abusing person and a personal substance abuse disorder, I should say. And then I got to talking to her, and I always had a very negative view of addicts and substance abuse. And these are the folks you see on the street and they're shooting up. Turns out that's not most of them aren't like that. Most of these folks are people that we see every day. Maybe we work with them. There were people that were abusing substances in our operating rooms, and eventually succumbed to, or this, first of all, they didn't succumb. They eventually got caught and got the help they needed. But it's a very widespread issue. I had a friend from high school who died from it, from substance abuse. That was, many years later. It was actually relatively recently, 2017, which just randomly coincided with my exploration of this idea. So being all around it and developing a compassion for these humans, these people who are being ravaged by these chemical dependencies, it destroys families, it destroys lives, businesses. And it's really a tragedy. And it's more so in America than it is in other countries. And it's more so in Appalachia than most places in America. And I thought, you know what? I'm tired of watching this happen. And if I don't do something about it, maybe nobody else will. I'm not going to leave it for the next guy.
Yeah. So it sounds like both a combination of professional and personal experiences and personal pain that you experienced that kind of led you to try to find a solution for this.
Yes, very well summarized. Yes, sir.
So you mentioned, as we were preparing for this, you mentioned that you quit your full-time job. You picked up some part-time anesthesia work in a different community. And you really started bootstrapping this whole operation. How much of your money did you have to invest in this to get you to where you are right now, if you don't mind sharing that?
Yeah, not at all. Over the last 4 years, I've invested about $500,000 of my personal income. Again, that was, some of it was, big payments, but a lot of it is just kind of ongoing.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. I remember the time when I signed the check for my first house purchase, and it was a pretty gut-wrenching feeling. What was your emotional state when you were deciding to bootstrap this, and did you realize that it was going to take that amount of money to get this to where you are right now?
Short answer, no. It's cost more than I thought it would. I was advised by a mentor to expect it will take me somewhere between 250 and 500,000. But again, that's, those numbers are from 2020. So, mm-hmm. Maybe he was kind of spot on, I guess. But the first number that shocked me was the first proof of concept study proposal that I got. And it was about $200,000. And I saw that and I almost choked. And I'm like, holy moly, where are we going to come up with this money? And I talked about it with my wife and we prayed about it. And I'll tell you what, Norm, money has shown up right when it's needed to. It's an amazing thing. But I'll tell you, the first time I had to wire 50 grand here, 75 grand there, 100 grand for this, it's the point now where if I get an invoice for $10,000, I'm like, that's a good one. Yeah. It's like, I got one the other day for $2,000 and I was like, do I tip the guy? So I'm joking, of course, but yeah, it's really changed my perspective. It was shocking at first and you quickly become numb to it. And then you also, I guess I'm kind of looking at it from the perspective of whose money is it anyway? Where does this money come from? Well, it comes from work that I'm doing, from a job that God has blessed me with, and with a skill set and a knowledge that God has blessed me with. So ultimately, all this money came from Him. And if this is what He's guiding me and leading me to do, I ought to do it.
Well, it's interesting because it almost sounds like, in a way, a faith-based mission for you, which I guess I didn't have that perspective as we talked about this, but it really does feel like a calling for you to help solve this opioid crisis and crises involving other medications and clinical conditions.
It's interesting, Norm, because it kind of crept up on me as well in the same way. When I first started thinking about this, it was just a business idea and then, doing the morally right thing. But as I've seen things unfold and just amazing, perfect coincidences and cash coming in and investors coming in right at the right time, you know, I've got to look up and know that, you know, there's something more to this than this isn't Joe. This isn't me. I'm not, you know, I didn't come up with this idea. I mean, yeah, I had some basic ideas, but I'll tell you, Norm, when we did our first proof of concept study, I was hoping that I'd be in the ballpark, but it was spot on. And that was just random happenstance, you know, a little bit of, you know, chemistry and a little bit of medical knowledge, but it worked so much better than I expected it would. I can't believe that was just chance. And I certainly don't claim to be a genius. That wasn't me.
You know, one thing I think would be interesting, because a lot of us don't know a lot of detail about the process that you have to go through with the FDA and with studies, those kinds of things. You've mentioned preclinical studies a few times. What have you learned about this whole process with the FDA and the time that it takes and the steps involved in that process? I wonder if you could share a little bit of that with us.
So I've learned a lot, but I also know that I know very little, probably compared to people who have been doing this for 20, 30 years. So I'm very much in the first rungs. So the FDA process is very drawn out, very expensive, very tedious. Very detail oriented, very regulated, and they have a very high set of standards, which is entirely appropriate. Importantly, the FDA also has a number of different pathways to get drugs approved. And it just so happens that with the reformulation strategy that we're using to address this opioid crisis and, you know, drug overdose deaths, we fit in very nicely with this, the secondary pathway. So when you come up with a whole new molecule, you have to prove that a medication is safe, it's non-toxic, you have to do long-term studies, you have to show that it's efficacious, you got to find a dose. But when you started out with something that, and that takes, by the way, 7 to 10 years and, you know, $100+ million. When you start out with a molecule that's already recognized as being safe and effective, you're just doing the reformulation. You just have to prove that the reformulation has not added any toxicities. And when we're changing this from an IV medication to an intramuscular medication, we have to prove that we're not going to cause any tissue injury at the injection site. So that shortens it changes the pathway. The formal pathway title is the 505B1 pathway, is when you're doing something entirely new. The reformulation pathway is the 505B2 pathway. And that shortens it from 7 to 10 years to about 2 to 3. And additionally, because of the tremendous need for this medication and because it's got such a wide safety profile, it fits into a high need pathway, or basically it gets fast track designation, which means that we get faster turnaround times every time we approach the FDA. But every time we ask the FDA a question or we need to meet with them, you know, it's at least a month. It feels like, well, actually it was 3 months initially, but lately it's been about 3 weeks to a month every time we exchange ideas or questions. So I've learned that it's very arduous, very expensive. It's more than I think the average person should spend time learning. And I think it's smartest, a better use of time to hire people who know this and do this for a living. And to that end, I've hired regulatory consultants that manage the nitty gritty. And then she'll come to me with decision making. If there's a fork in the road, she's, what do you want to do here? I can do the strategy part of stuff.
So this question may be a little bit political, and I didn't get a chance to run this by you, but I've been fascinated by some of the conversations that have been occurring because of the change in the leadership at the FDA. And Dr. Makary is someone that I had followed for a long time while he was at Johns Hopkins. He was a very, very prominent physician in terms of safety and quality, and I had really respected a lot of his writings. But what, if anything, do you think will be the changes, positive or negative, that restructure specifically in terms of getting new drugs to market?
That's a great question, Norm, and I think it's one that has yet to be answered. If I'm forecasting based on the likes and dislikes of the current administration and their style, they will push back on drugs that are expensive or maybe don't offer as much utility. I don't know that to be a fact. That's just my guess. But it seems like they are in favor of developing medications that save lives. In fact, that's one of their points is that they want to reduce deaths from fentanyl. And I'm going to extrapolate that and say, you know, if somebody dies from a different type of drug overdose, they wouldn't be okay with that. So, you know, they're trying to stop fentanyl at the border and then going after folks who are distributing it. But I am encouraged, but at the same time, I don't have any data yet. I honestly haven't seen any change. I guess our first reaching out to the FDA occurred right after the election. So in November, I think was when we reached out to them. And, you know, there's been no change in rate of correspondence. So, you know, neither good nor bad, but I'm at least hopeful and optimistic.
Okay. So we talk a lot about resilience in all types of physician ventures. What would you mind sharing what one of the biggest failures you've experienced as you've started up this pharmaceutical company, and what did you learn from that?
So I haven't had any big failures yet, knock on wood. Yeah, everything we've done has been successful. The one thing I would do differently if I was restarting with the knowledge I have now is I would plan more steps ahead, because everything takes longer to come to fruition than you think. So, you know, most recently, you know, we've got the first preclinical FDA studies coming up, followed by the first human studies or healthy volunteer studies. And with that, we need to have a formulation that's been created in a FDA certified lab, what they call GMP, good manufacturing practices. And I thought that was only going to take 2 to 3 weeks. Like, yeah, just bang it out. I kind of told them what we need and like, yeah, we can, you know, we'll get these in, we'll mix it up, we'll run it through our special process and here we go. And that's not the case. They said it'll be 2 to 3 months. So everything else is kind of on hold because of that. So those are things I would do differently.
So you embarked on this journey, but I wanted to ask you, what role do you think physicians, maybe physicians who are still practicing, play in reshaping the pharmaceutical industry? It is a very big part of what we do as physicians, and it does seem like we're kind of at their mercy in terms of the cost structure or when things are going to become generic. And how has this adventure that you're on, or this journey that you're on, created an impression in your mind about the role that we should play in trying to fix the pharmaceutical industry, if you feel that that's an appropriate term?
I do think it's absolutely appropriate. I think there's a lot of things that's broken in the pharmaceutical industry, and I don't even necessarily blame the industry. I blame just kind of our need for growth. And, you know, we got to satisfy the shareholders. So everyone's fighting to survive and acquiring companies to grow and get a bigger corner of the market. So there's a couple of different ways physicians can help shape the future of the pharmaceutical industry. Every single physician who prescribes medications, so basically everyone, can begin by choosing medications that work, that are most cost effective, rather than pushing the latest and greatest newfangled medication. You know, if the latest medication is no better than generic lisinopril, then why prescribe it? We just get used to doing something new, which I have no problem with prescribing new drugs. You know, we need that, and especially if it provides a benefit. But I'll see a lot of older patients who are on, you know, copious amounts of medications, paying huge amounts monthly. And when I look at it, you know, it's not my decision as their anesthesiologist, but I'm looking at this list and I'm thinking, I wonder how many of these medications they actually need to be on. Could they pare this down? And I think if physicians were more choosy about the cost of the medications they're prescribing and choosing generics, I think that would disincentivize pharmaceutical companies from making a new drug in the same class. Like, how many different PPIs do we need? Absolutely, some work better than others for certain people. There's going to be, you know, pharmacogenetics that play along in that. But, you know, we can each make a difference in choosing less expensive drugs. The other side of things, and I don't know how much of a the pharmaceutical industry needs to see value in this, but I would love for the pharmaceutical industry to spend more time with physicians and as maybe consultants or have them on their boards to be able to influence development of drugs in such a way that it's more geared towards patient care and maybe cures and rather than treatments.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it is an industry that's just fraught with opportunity to try to make it work better. Some of these drugs are so costly, and we have high deductible plans right now and the negative impact on patients. But I like what you said, too, because I think deprescribing and methodically deprescribing medications is something that physicians do really need to embrace. I read a study once that said by the time you're on six medications, there's a high probability that you're suffering from drug-drug interactions. And oftentimes we treat the symptom from a drug-drug interaction with another drug, which then just increases the potential of having additional drug-drug interactions. It's almost impossible to keep prescribing more medications without these adverse reactions compiling for patients.
Yeah. I hadn't heard that study, but I completely believe that.
So before we wrap up, and I really appreciate the amount of time that you're taking, but I have a couple more questions. Number one, I guess, is when do you see Auros as getting this life-saving product, potential life-saving product, I should say, since you haven't completed all your studies, but this product out on the market so that it can have the impact that you envision?
This medication could conceivably be ready and available in 2 years. And I don't think that's overly optimistic. It's just a matter of once we get the ball started, getting through the FDA and beginning the what they call the IND investigational new drug designation, we'll be off.
That's great. So that's really, as far as drug development goes, and as you said, because you're doing the reformulation, that's a pretty shorter window than I would have thought possible.
It also started in 21. So, yes. You know, 2 years from now, it'll be 27. So it's 6 years. And I'll tell you, if I had really deep pockets and I knew what I need now, I could probably get it done in about half the time.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is financially limited.
So a lot of PEMBA alumni will be familiar with the term OAP. Was starting the pharmaceutical company your OAP when you attended PEMBA?
It was. Okay.
Where did you get the most support? Who were the main mentors that you relied on at University of Tennessee to kind of help guide you in that OAP?
His name was Mike. Is it Mike Stoltz? Does that name ring a bell
Mike
for you?
Stahl? Is it Mike Stahl?
That's it. Mike Stahl. It was on the tip of my brain. Mike Stahl was a tremendous guy. He was in the pharmaceutical industry himself. He put up with me during my OAP. God bless him. He retired shortly after I finished. I hope I didn't have a part in that. But he was a great guy. And he also introduced me to Francois Nader, who also is a PEMBA grad, I believe, in 84, maybe. And Francois is just a fantastic individual, a great human, also seems to be a very godly man. And he's been always receptive to my calls. So I'd say those two were the biggest mentors through PEMBA.
So Francois was actually a guest on our show last year, and it was a fascinating conversation. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to that, or for any listeners who haven't listened to it, you should go back and look at that, listen to that podcast episode.
I definitely will.
That's great.
Thank you for that advice. I didn't know that he was a guest on here. That's great.
Yes, he was. And the other thing I like to ask all of our alumni as they come on the show is what is your favorite memory of PEMBA when you were attending?
I think we had a unique experience because of the COVID situation. And it allowed for a unique type of bonding where we were all geared together against this invisible, quite scary enemy of COVID. I'd say that was a tremendous memory, and remembering how our class came together and we were all very helpful with each other, and it made a lot of cohesiveness. It added a lot of cohesiveness to our group. And I think that was a tremendous, a unique experience that I hope no other future class experiences.
Well, thank you for that recollection. And Joseph, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you and your time for being on the show today. I wish you all the best of luck with your endeavor here with your pharmaceutical company. And I hope that you'll find it as easy to eliminate future barriers as you've had eliminating ones that you've come up against so far.
Thank you so much, Norm. I appreciate it. And I think I appreciate you taking the time to ask these questions and getting the information out there. You're clearly a well-founded man, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And just for the audience, we will be including some information in the show notes about Oros and Joseph's hope for the company. So if any of you have any other questions, you'll have some resources that you can use to get that information that you need. So thanks again, Joseph, for joining us today.
Thank you, Norm. Appreciate it. It was great chatting with you.
Thanks for listening to Dr. Ninu, a physician entrepreneur driven by faith, fueled by Pemba, and committed to solving one of America's most devastating public health crises. Joseph's journey reminds us that leadership isn't always about climbing height. It's often about stepping out, taking risks, and being willing to start again. Whether you're still in the OR or deep into a leadership role, his story is a powerful call to examine your own potential to lead change, not just within your organization, but across the healthcare system. To learn more about Oros Pharma or connect with Dr. Ninu, check out the show notes for the links and resources. And if you found today's episode meaningful, we'd love for you to share it with a fellow Pemba alum or another physician leader. Join me in 2 weeks for episode 45 of Pemba On Demand. My guest will be Dr. Tom Loeb, sharing the value he has found in using a foundation to achieve his goals as a physician, entrepreneur, and philanthropist. Until next time, keep dreaming boldly, leading courageously, and never underestimate the power of an idea backed by action. Pemba On Demand is released biweekly, every other Thursday, and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.